Welcome, everybody. How's that sound? Is that all right? Welcome to the hybrid John Jay Homestead and to our temporary venue. I'm Melissa Vail, trustee of the Friends and chair of the Scholars Committee. And we are excited to have so many of you here in person and many more of you remotely. Welcome, especially to the teachers and students in both parts of our audience, especially to the members of the new History Club at Fox Lane High School, from whom you'll hear more shortly. Right there. Raise your hand so we can welcome you. Thank you for coming. All right. Now, everyone, please turn off your phones. First, webinar logistics for our remote attendees. You're muted and video view is turned off. If you have technical problems, please use the chat function for messages to your host. We already have some questions for our speaker, but we'll try to squeeze in some more. Please use the chat feature for those if when the time comes. Thank yous to the Bedford Playhouse for taking us in during the closing of Bedford House, and watch the Homestead's site for news of exciting construction and reinterpretation projects. Special thanks to our lectures committee for their indispensable support of these talks, and to our outstanding public partner, the New York State Office of Parks, Recreation, and Historic Preservation, for everything. And as always, and most important, to our members, who are our reason for being. Quick show of hands, how many of you here are already members? Good. And that means there are some more, and we still have room for you if you choose to join soon. Thank you in advance. Please look at the Friends website for our last talk in this exciting season on May 7th. Justice Stephen Breyer, retired, will be talking about his new book, Rereading the Constitution, Why I Chose Pragmatism, Not Textualism. And note, the not in that title is emphasized, it's italicized. And I hate to say, but we have the champagne problem for that talk of being at capacity for in-person tickets, but not, of course, for Zoom. Now, here's a Zoom feature that we're keeping, the survey. I'm going to ask you a question, and I want a lightning response by show of hands on Zoom, too. We're keeping track of you, Emily is. I'll be giving you some background shortly, but for the moment, suppose this country had ended the revolution without becoming independent of Britain, but rather with something like the Commonwealth status of Canada or Australia. Would we now be better off today, worse off today, or about the same? I want your quick responses. Would we be better off today? Raise your hands. Okay, that's maybe five. Would six, would we be worse off today? Lots. And would we be about the same? Oh, switch one, switch Laura. Okay. Emily, you're our in-house mathematician. How did sometimes the Zoom answers come in with different distribution from the in-person? How did we do?
So we're on a two-lecture streak now with online results aligning with in-person results. It's about 10% said better off, 70% worse off, and 20% same.
Okay. Good. So, and then Lige will tell us whether he agrees with us or not later. The last part from me before you get to hear our speaker, those of you who've come to our talks before know that we always look for a J connection to the topic of the evening. Now, here's the background to the survey question. John Jay was one of the three peace commissioners who negotiated the Treaty of Paris, which ended the Revolutionary War, and was then called America's Treaty of Peace and Independence. The other two commissioners were John Adams and Benjamin Franklin, and it was Jay who insisted that Britain acknowledge the independence of the United States, which was not then a thing, before any negotiations could start, in violation of expressed instructions from Congress and in disagreement with his two fellow commissioners. Was this a triumph? At the Homestead, we have been telling it that way, but Professor Gould will share with us a line of research that gives a different interpretation. as with almost everything in history. We'll let him tell that story shortly. So now our speaker, Elijah Gould, is professor of history at the University of New Hampshire, where he has been honored for excellence in teaching and research. He's been named the 2025 to 26 Harmsworth Visiting Professor of American History at Oxford. He's also the author of, among other books, the multiple award-winning Among the Powers of the Earth, The American Revolution, and the Making of a New World Empire, which, among other themes, discusses how the American desire to be seen as treaty-worthy guided American policy and growth for many decades. Note, Crucible of Peace, the book he's talking about tonight, is still a work in progress under contract with Oxford University Press, and this is actually a working title, subject to change. We may have an opportunity to affect the final version. A reminder about questions, we have a ton of questions pre-submitted and won't be passing around a mic. But if you have one, text your host and put it in the chat, or put it in the chat and we'll try to squeeze it in. So, Professor Gould, I would like to start with a question from one of our scholars committee. What was life like in Paris when Jay and Franklin were living there?
The Hotel de York, where the definitive treaty was signed, still stands. You can see it. It's in Paris's Latin Quarter. So in some aspects of Paris, as it was in 1783, still exist, but it was a very different city. So Benjamin Franklin's residence in Passy was out in the countryside. And today we were trying to remember which arrondissement it is. I think it's the 16th. They've got a treaty of a statue of Franklin there, but it's urban space. So, and one of the things I like to do when I'm writing and certainly when I'm teaching is to try to put myself into the shoes of people at the time. How long did it take to get by carriage from the Hotel de York, where the Anglo-American Treaty was signed on the morning of September 3rd, out to Versailles, where the British treaty with France and Spain was signed. That's where the big signing ceremony was. How long does it take? How do you get there? What are the roads like? So it takes some imagination because, of course, Paris has been rebuilt many times, most famously in the 1870s by Haussmann.
Now a question from one of our students. Is this working? Is that okay? Okay. Grant Klein, founder of the Fox Lane American History Club. America was fortunate in that the nation found itself relatively stable after emerging from a revolution. Other revolts, like the French Revolution, launched their nations into anarchy. What allowed America to emerge strong after the revolution?
Well, there's a lot in there. Actually, one factoid that's worth bearing in mind is that we tend to think of the American Revolution as a bloodless or relatively bloodless, and yet more emigres, loyalists, as a share of the population leave the United States in 1783 than leave either France or Russia during their revolution. So, in fact, there is quite a significant outmigration, about 60,000 at the end of the war. That's in response to acts of violence. There's quite a lot of irregular violence, both patriots on Tories and Tories on patriots. There's a lot of tit for tat bloodletting. So, in that sense, I think one of the things we're coming to realize is that the American Revolution did actually have things in common with some of those other more violent revolutions. I would say the thing the United States benefited from is the fact that it was an ocean away from the great powers that really threatened it. And that's a major difference between the American Revolution and, excuse me, the French Revolution or the Russian Revolution. So while there are threats on the borders of the United States that we can talk about, nothing like the invasions that France faced, for example, in the 1790s, where you've got an Austrian army on your borders. So that in some ways, I think it's more the geographical location. They're quite fortunate in that.
And not so much the new political structure or the peacemaking or... reconciliation. You point out.
Yeah, that's a tough one. But it kind of depends on where you are and where you look. Here in New York, here in Westchester County, the War of Independence is a civil war. The struggle between the Skinners and the Cowboys, between Whig partisans and Tory partisans, that's a nasty, nasty war. And that continues right up till 1783. In fact, when the peace treaty arrives, their partisans, for which that rather than marking the end of the war, it's like, okay, here's our chance to really get back at those guys. A fair number of the loyalists who leave from New York starting in the spring of 1783, right through to November, and it's a 6-month process, and so many want to leave that General Carleton, the commandant of the British garrison, is forced to postpone his departure by months. He wanted to get out of here as quickly as he could, and he can't because there's so many leaving, and a lot of it has to do with that with that violence. That said, then the story of the gradual reconciliation and the integration of loyalists back into civil society, the development of friendly relations across the borders, that's an important part of the story too. It's a fascinating and complicated story, in fact.
I know that at the homestead, we have some important stone walls, and the stone walls were built for a couple of reasons. You had to put the rocks somewhere, but they also had to build walls out of stone because there were no trees, because the trees had all been taken out and burned and seized.
Yes.
And carried off.
Yes, yeah. So, and that is, and actually a lot of the fighting outside of New York City. It's also true in Charleston, where Henry Lawrence's son, John, is killed. He's killed during a foraging raid. The British are penned up in these cities, and gradually they're cutting the wood that they can get to. And so they're having to go farther and farther out into the countryside. And indeed, one of the things that the British do is they deforest. So that's a very good point. I didn't realize that was part of the homestead story. That's,
yeah. We've got lots of stories.
Yeah.
When we open again, so come back. Now, I want to back up and ask you to do the impossible, which is a lightning review of Among the Powers of the Earth.
Yes.
Which is right here. That's the one that we're selling upstairs. You coined the phrase treaty worthy.
Yeah.
And talk about the impact on this new country of belonging to the community of the European great powers.
Yes.
Why did that matter, and what did a country need to do to join that community?
So, So the United States is the first European style nation to emerge outside of Europe. And it declares independence in a space that Europeans had only occupied as colonists. So the mere fact of that declaration of independence is hugely important. But and it's a point I'm making in the book I'm finishing now, independence is actually a three-legged stool. There's Declaration of Independence, there's a Charter of Government, the Articles of Confederation, Constitution 1.0, but you also need the recognition of the powers that you're seeking to join, including ultimately the power that you're seceding from. So, and in order to have that, you need a treaty. so that the drive to be treaty worthy is a tremendously powerful motivating force and shaping force for the early United States. And then among the powers, I actually start this before the revolution. I open with the sort of the law of nations as it existed in the late colonial period during the what we call the French and Indian War, the Seven Years' War, and then follow it right the way up into the early 19th century. The final chapter is about the first Seminole War when Andrew Jackson, the Napoleon of the woods, invades Florida. And it's built around the United States' quest to be accepted by particularly its European neighbors, Britain, France, and Spain, as a nation worthy of having treaties with. And it's a complicated process. Partly it's a matter of having the power to be treaty worthy, both externally to force other nations to recognize you, but also the ability to govern internally so that you can actually abide by treaties. And it also is a matter of conforming to certain norms. And in among the powers, I do a lot with the question of slavery. I think one of the reasons why the United States is a leader in the movement to abolish slavery, starting in 1776, is the desire to be accepted by enlightened nations and opinion in Europe. And yet it's also a tension, because that treaty worthiness also creates the space for the slaveholding states to continue practicing slavery. So it's a very complicated, it's a double-edged sword too.
And you also talk about how the abolition of slavery did not equal the abolition of the slave trade.
Exactly.
And the protection of your ships at sea.
Right, yeah.
And that was, yeah, that created all sorts of crazy incentives.
Right, yes. Well, and one of the really fascinating figures, and he emerges really on the national scene at the time of Jackson's invasion of Florida, but it's John Quincy Adams, the Secretary of State in James Monroe's administration. And both Adamses are very staunchly anti-slavery. But John Quincy Adams, as opposed as he is to slavery, he's also a nationalist. And one of the big issues with Britain in the decades after the War of 1812 is the policing of the illegal slave trade. And much as Adams is opposed to the illegal slave trade, he also doesn't want Royal Navy ships stopping American flag vessels, which is the best way to prohibit the illegal slave trade. So we see Adams, he's really wrestling with these two sides. And, it's a reminder just how complicated and messy history oftentimes is.
Well, and you talk about the law of nations, and this field is new to me. And I had thought of the law of nations as being quite a universal thing. But on this business of governing the territories, it's new territories.
Yes.
They're interacting with all sorts of groups that do not share the law of nations.
Right.
And so please explain how that works.
So, the law of nations itself is a moving target.
Mm-hmm.
At the time of the American Revolution, the law of nations is the law of nations, so that the objects of international law, as we would call it today, are states. And so the purpose of the law of nations is to regulate and protect sovereigns. And individual rights tend to be subordinated to that. And you only have rights insofar as you are a subject or a citizen of a nation. And that's actually one of the reasons why this treaty worthiness is so hugely important, because your best chance for having rights that are secure in international space are as a citizen of a treaty-worthy nation. If your nation is not accepted within that community, you're in a much more vulnerable position. And that's very different. Today, we think of the international law does, in fact, protect individuals as well as nations. But it's a very different story in 1776 and in the years going forward. So it tends to place anyone who is in an ambiguous relationship to a state, to a European-style state, in a very perilous position. Enslaved people, indigenous peoples, Native Americans are in a very kind of liminal position in here, but Europeans as well. I actually opened the book with the Acadian removal, the neutral French. Actually, my own family, the Goulds, are Acadians, removed during this event, who, because they're not fully subject of either Britain or France in Nova Scotia, are vulnerable to being removed, as they actually are in the 1750s, about 10,000. Are put on to actually put on to, they use slave ships to ship them down the coast to Massachusetts, New York, Pennsylvania, Maryland. They're sent up and down the Atlantic seaboard. So,
and they became Cajuns.
That, right, in Louisiana, they become Cajuns. My family stays in Nova Scotia, we're Acadians, but. So being in that liminal state is to be in a very vulnerable position. And it's one of the reasons why statehood and independence matters so much at the time of the American Revolution. Certainly one of the reasons why Jay is so adamant that George III recognized the United States as independent. There's a lot riding on it.
Mm-hmm. A side issue was the right on the right to all British possessions. That meant the right to dominate the people or to govern the people that the British had been governing, right?
Yes.
Or not completely. How does that work?
Well, you're talking about empire.
Yeah.
And so empire is, it's actually, it's a fascinating word. It's got two meanings. Its first meaning is actually, you know, Latin command. And in its purest meaning, at least in English political thought, it originates in Henry VIII's Reformation, where he declares this kingdom is an empire, meaning it is not subject to anyone else, i.e. the Pope or the Holy Roman Emperor. And if you'll notice, King Charles's crown is closed at the top. That's an imperial crown. So that's its first meaning. But in order to be a functioning empire, the English believe, and the Americans inherit this from the English, lock, stock, and barrel, that they also need to control the space around them. And the greatest threat to empire in the sense of independence is the threat of fifth columns and stateless people and groups. Let me be clear here. I'm ventriloquizing. I'm speaking the way people at the time would have thought. But they regarded unattached people, brigands, indigenous people, Acadians, neutral people, people who are insufficiently attached to the government as citizens, stateless people, are quite threatening. So that imperial dominance over such groups becomes part of what an empire in the independent sense needs to do in order to have self-mastery. And you certainly see this in the American thinking of empire. So that although the negotiators in Paris care first and foremost about independence from Britain, they also think they need the borders on this map, and this is the British treaty map from those negotiations, to achieve empire in that sense, so that you get a sort of geographically capacious empire as well as an empire in the sense of independence, and they work together.
One more question about the revolution, then I'm going to ask you to tell us about this map. To what extent was the revolution a tax revolt? And what about the fact that you discuss in Powers that being independent cost about five times what the colonies had been paying to Britain?
Yeah, so
it was wicked more expensive.
Yeah, so there's a wonderful historian from 100 years ago, Carl Lotus Becker, wrote it's actually a history of the political parties of New York. And Becker has a wonderful formulation where he said, the American Revolution is actually two revolutions. It's a struggle for home rule i.e. independence, but it's also a struggle over who will rule at home. So yes, it is a tax revolt, but it is also a revolt to establish home rule, and home rule is expensive. If all you care about is low taxes, you probably don't want to be independent. Taxes in colonies tend to be a lot lower than they are in independent nations, because you got to pay for your own, the full cost of your own defense. The taxes that started the American Revolution are only to pay for part of the cost of having those regulars out in Indian country. They were never going to pay the full cost of expense. It's only to pay part of it. So part of being independent means is you're taking on those full expenses. So yes, it does go up. But this tension plays itself out, and it's one of the huge tensions, certainly in the 1780s that I'm writing about now, in Virginia and Kentucky, where my mother's family's from. Part of the Virginia's Western District, the only way to keep them within Virginia without just unilaterally declaring independence is by not taxing. The Spanish control what is West Florida above Natchez. They claim all the way to the Tennessee River. The only way to keep that under control is by not taxing, so that you get, and in Canada, the one of the ways that the British are able to hang on to Canada is by not taxing. Taxes are actually much heavier in the metropolitan core of the United States in places like Westchester County than they are out in the periphery. And so it in and that tension, I mean, obviously it's still with us. We don't like paying taxes, and yet we've got a government that we have to pay taxes to. Who likes paying taxes?
Taxes are what you pay for civilization.
Well, I'm inclined to agree with that, but I'm a Hamiltonian.
Yep. So give us now a lightning summary of the negotiations or of the negotiations for the treaty, and tell us or start either with the negotiations or with this map, or to the extent that you can mash them together. You choose.
Well, let me start by saying the negotiations begin as soon as the fighting begins. One of the interesting things about Britain is they are waging this for a negotiated peace. The Howe brothers in 1776 come over as peace commissioners. Every British commander in chief is also a peace commissioner. So in that way, it's very different. It's a British Civil War. Let's remember that. Mm-hmm. It's very different from Mr. Lincoln's war during the American Civil War, where Lincoln is fighting for total victory, unconditional surrender. The British do not fight for that. So the peace negotiations are ongoing. But the peace that Britain would have wanted and they formalized this in 1778 after France enters the war, is a kind of Commonwealth relationship. They send the Earl of Carlisle over first to Philadelphia, and then after the British leave Philadelphia, comes up to New York, writes his wife letters complaining about mosquitoes the size of sparrows. He hates America. The summer's unbearable. But what he's offering is Commonwealth status. He will give Americans everything they want. He's actually willing to accept the Earls of Confederation as part of the British Imperial Constitution. You can elect your governors, all of this. But you have to accept George III as your sovereign. So it's like the Canadian situation to this. And Ireland, actually, the Irish see this and they want it and they get it in 1782, actually, while Carlisle is their Lord Lieutenant. So this is on offer, and it's what Britain wants right up until Jay holds out for Richard Oswald, and this is his map, is the British Peace Commissioner, to get a commission to negotiate with the United States of America. So the that's a great victory. It's not quite the same thing as a treaty. Jay himself has to come off the dime just a little bit. But so that's the first, but except for France, and France doesn't want that kind of outcome, most of the rest of Europe, including Spain, would have liked that. And then the Spanish, although they're allied with the United States in every way but through a treaty, are worried, of course, because the United States is potentially an example to their own American colonies. The Spanish are sort of our frenemies. So the first objective is this question of independence. But then there's the question about boundaries. And that's fascinating, because France, they're all in on American independence, but they're not all in on the United States extending beyond the Appalachians. They're envisioning the United States as a coastal federation, confederation, that they think they're going to be able to dominate. And that's partly because they worry about American power. It's also because the French are in a dynastic alliance with Spain, and the Spanish really don't want the United States on the Mississippi River. It's the other reason why that Spain refuses to negotiate a treaty with the United States. So there's a real standoff here. And Britain and the British suggest a separate negotiation just with the American Peace Commissioners. Now, the Americans let the French know that they're holding these negotiations, and they start in after Richard Oswald's commission with Jay's recognition of the United States arrives. So they go into conference. Most of the negotiations happen in October and November. They discuss boundaries, all sorts of things. And the Earl of Shelburne, who is the British Prime Minister, he's actually an Irishman, and he really wants an Irish solution to independence. Bows to reality, accepts independence, and what he wants now is to get the United States out of their alliance with France. And he realizes they can do that by giving the United States the Mississippi River. Jay and Adams are all in on these negotiations. Franklin, who's much friendlier to the French, says, "I'll go along with you, and I'll say nothing to the French. They say nothing to us, after all." So even Franklin comes around. And at the end of November, they sign a provisional peace treaty with the borders that you see on this. And this is Richard Oswald's map from the preliminary treaty negotiations, which he sent to George III. It's from the King's Library, and in writing, George III has written on this map Mr. Oswald's borders. So when the Comte de Vergennes, the French foreign minister, sees what Shelburne has done, he can't believe it. He had no idea that Britain would agree to these borders. Now, they don't get everything they wanted. Franklin, in particular, believes the only way the United States can have lasting peace, to your point about stability, is if the United States occupies all of British North America. And to his dying days, this is a great disappointment to Franklin. And he sees that kind of greater United States as holding the key to peace, both with European powers and also in Indian country. Mm-hmm. So the U.S. doesn't get everything it wants, but it gets the Mississippi, which neither France nor Spain wanted the United States to get.
And that was for trade power going forward. And it was also for to have a clear and defensible border, because we talk about the rivalry between the European powers as partly a desire to keep the United States weak so that they can come back in and pick it off again. Yes. Yeah.
That is true. And So Shelburne, I mean, he's making a sacrifice. There are people who questioned whether Britain would be able to hang on to the land west of the Appalachians. And in fact, Kentucky in 1783 already has 12,000 inhabitants, mainly around, Boonesboro and Lexington. Daniel Boone, again, I grew up a son of a Kentucky mother. I grew up hearing about this. And people are flooding into Kentucky. Its population is close to 100,000 by 1790. It's where the population is really growing. They aren't really going north of the Ohio. That's where they're going. And so Shelburne, reasons that Britain may not be able to hang on to this anyway. But he knows that the colonies, and all the colonies had Western charters. Actually, in the case of Connecticut, they go all the way to the Pacific. Mm-hmm. But their royal charters from Britain gave them this land. So Britain is sort of bowing to necessity, is recognizing those as legitimate. It actually means that Quebec, whose border had been lowered to the Ohio River in 1774. Is partitioned, and this is a treaty of partition on a couple of levels. But he's basically negotiating a very lenient peace. But he's also, the other calculation is Europeans are worried about American maritime power. They're worried about the development of American manufacturing, and they're at odds how best to keep Americans from developing from an agrarian society. Shelburne is of the view that by giving the United States the Mississippi to expand to, it'll postpone American industrialization. And by the 1780s, Britain is already a major industrial power. The British factories are already, developing. The first steam engines are being used. There are actually two in America by this time. Mm-hmm. So that they're thinking about this. And this is also a way to keep the United States agrarian for longer. So that's part of the thinking, too.
Your talk, hold on, there was a thought in there. Your talk about whether it was an unalloyed triumph to achieve independence. You said that there's an academic argument out there that says that maybe Jay overreached and that there may have been some negative consequences to that. So that's a fun story.
So the book I'm writing for Oxford University Press, for their trade wing, I'm writing as a narrative history. Mm-hmm. And we think of narrative history as popular history, but the analytic is huge. Mm-hmm. And what happened? So Jay holds out, says, nope, we're not going to talk borders until you recognize us as independent. And so, Oswald says, okay. And, he sends off, and this is where Shelburne finally, recognizes he's not going to get his Irish solution to the American problem. Before that happened, Oswald's very friendly to the idea of giving the United States all of North America, including Nova Scotia and Canada. Oswald supports that. And he and Franklin had been talking, and it looked like this might come to pass. Well, in the interval, when Oswald has to wait for the British cabinet to sign off on the United States of America, Gibraltar holds. And in fact, Britain's greatest military period in the war is in 1782. It's a year of victories. They destroy the French fleet off Jamaica at the Battle of the Saints. Gibraltar holds. They win victories in India. And so by late September, all of a sudden, Britain doesn't feel like it needs to give the United States quite as much as they might have, so that the proposal had been to give make the border above the Great Lakes, to give the United States much of what is today Ontario's industrial heartland. Had that happened, it's hard to see how Canada would have been viable as the independent dominion that it became. And not surprisingly, diplomatic historians have written about this. I try to stay out of this. But those who are friendlier to Franklin think that Jay kind of blew it. Richard Morris, who wrote the Bancroft Prize winning book on it, is very pro-Jay. So he tends to sort of play that down. But there are historians who, you know, blame Jay just a bit for, you know, missing a chance.
That also just points out how this war was a true world war.
Totally. Yeah. And the last, so I've got a whole chapter on the armistice. That is the timing by which the combatants made peace. Before the invention of the telegraph, wars did not end on November 11th at 11 o'clock as the First World War did. Instead, they end in time zones. And this treaty was no exception. The armistice is dated from the Anglo-French treaty. And that provisional treaty is signed at Versailles in January of 1783. And then it's timed out. And the last place where the war ends is in India, where it ends 5 months later. And so the last shots of the War of American Independence are fired in India. And there's a big debate over when the war ends here in actually New York, because there's a question about whether the time zone, including the United States, is going to be measured by latitude, which is how it had been measured in 1763, and they're taking the language from that treatise, or if they're going to use longitude, which is the new technology. And if you use longitude, which the British use, they've got an extra month to take American ships. And so the British Vice Admiralty Court, and the judge is John Adams's co-partner from his law practice in the 1760s. And you know, Flowers, he knows he's wrong, and you know, and Jay's involved in this too. There's just it's a huge issue. It's actually still an issue during the Jay Treaty, because there are hundreds of thousands of pounds, millions of dollars today, at stake in ships that are captured in that interval, and it's a fascinating so. And it's one of those things, if you tell the story in a chronological narrative way, it really jumps out at you.
Mm-hmm. There are so many pieces that it's hard for me to know how to zero in on a question. You have mentioned, you describe the Treaty of Paris as a treaty of partition. And we think of treaties of partition as coming in India, or in Ireland, or in Palestine.
Yes.
And tell us what you mean by that, and yeah, how that worked. And we think of it, we think of that word as being very, very harsh.
Yeah.
And that you're obviously giving a lot of harsh meaning to that.
And this comes back to this question of stability. So I'm very influenced in this by a book by the Irish historian Nicholas Manser, who wrote a book about imperial partitions, I think it's say in the 1960s, mainly focusing on the Irish story, but also looking at India. It doesn't have much to say about the Palestine-Israeli partition. But classically, we tend to think of partitions. And again, if we think of, and this gets back to this question about the United States as remaining within a British Commonwealth, that's one of the things that Carlyle has to offer in 1778. You get to remain part of the British Empire, and partly it's Canada, but it's also the West Indies. They don't show up in this map, but that's a hugely important market for merchants in New England, also in New York, Philadelphia. So, but we tend to think of partitions as actions from above that imperial powers impose on their colonies, and they kind of are, and the treaty makers do impose a partition on what had been the unified British American Empire. But Mansar says they're also the results of civil wars. And usually partitions are driven by the wishes of the people on the ground. And that definitely is what happened here. In 1782, before the treaty arrives, there's reason to think that eventually Nova Scotia, and there are a lot of patriots in Nova Scotia, my Acadian forebears, fight with Massachusetts to bring Nova Scotia into the Union. They're Acadian patriots, and there are quite a lot of Yankee settlers up in Nova Scotia to be open to that. Once 30,000 of those 60,000 loyalists end up in Nova Scotia, it's a totally different ballgame. And actually, they partition Nova Scotia, creating New Brunswick, which is created as an ultra-loyalist colony, partly because they don't trust the Nova Scotians. So right on the border with Massachusetts is this new ultra-loyalist colony. And it guarantees that there is not going to be a greater United States with Nova Scotia as the 14th state. Or Canada. You know, eventually the Floridas do join, but that's a very different story. But and it's also the loyalists who insist upon shutting the Americans out of the West Indies. The author of the British Order on July 2nd, 1783, shutting the West Indies, is a loyalist, an Irish loyalist named William Knox, who had lost land in Georgia. And he just can't wait to stick to the Americans. Mm-hmm. So that in many ways, it's the loyalists who are driving the bus, and it's the loyalists who drive Shelburne from power. And Shelburne had been very open to the idea of a lenient peace treaty, not only with these lands in the West, but allowing the Americans to continue trading within the British navigation laws, which would have created also a very different Anglo-American relationship. In many ways, the loyalists who ultimately destroy the Confederation and force Americans to do a do-over with the Constitution in 1787, as much as anything, that's Britain's rejection. They say, we're not going to negotiate a treaty with you because you're not treaty worthy. You're not worthy of it. And so that's a driving force behind the Constitution.
So that could go in two directions. You could talk more about what would have been wrong with keeping a Confederation relationship with Britain. And also, what does partition mean? Does it mean hard borders, or does it mean the creation of a stateless people? Right. Or does it sometimes yes and sometimes no?
It does all of those things. And the fact of partition, you know, it begs out for finding a modus vivendi, a way of getting along. And a lot of it happens with smuggling. One of the ironies is these loyalists are very happy to, you know, that they're not willing to allow the law. They don't want Americans legally trading, but they're very happy to be involved in smuggling. And it, actually, you can read his letters. The future Admiral Nelson, young Captain Nelson, commands the Leeward Islands station in Antigua from 1784 to 1787. He writes beautifully. And he just cannot stand seeing these American ships coming into the West Indies trading illegally, and he knows it's the loyalists helping them. And Nelson has no truck with the idea that the loyalists are really loyal. He says they're as bad as the rebels. He actually calls them rebels. And one of the things we know about the loyalists is they, too, had opposed parliamentary taxation. It's really only on the crown that they differ with the Americans. They have a lot in common constitutionally. And Captain Nelson picks this up. And so these hardened borders, but they also create zones of statelessness and, you know, trading back and forth. Benedict Arnold is in New Brunswick trading illegally across the border. You know, what gives?
Again, I'm trying to figure out what's the next best question to get to. Talk about the native sovereign populations, because that's something that coming from the New York area, those conflicts are had already been suppressed by the time there was the revolution. But talk about the Spanish lands in Florida and how this treaty
so
that.
Indigenous people, Native Americans, are not mentioned in either peace treaty, either Britain's peace treaty with the United States or Britain's treaty, the Treaty of Versailles with Spain. And this is a great betrayal, because the Britain's native allies had really held the line against Americans. Joseph Brant, the Mohawk war chief from upstate New York, Canajoharie in the Mohawk Valley, is undefeated in battle. He's victorious in the Mohawk Valley. He's victorious on the Ohio River. He hadn't lost anything, but at the end of the war, they're not mentioned in the treaty. Native Americans aren't. And Congress declares the Native people to be in the same position as the Loyalists, having forfeited their lands because they chose the wrong side. And for Brant, and there's also a story south of the river, but Brant is from the Six Nations, the Iroquois or Haudenosaunee Confederacy, who had been mentioned in the Peace of Utrecht of 1713. In fact, a lot of Britain's claims to North America depended upon the Iroquois' own sovereignty over the Western Indians. So to be left out of this treaty is a great betrayal. And then to be told that they had been defeated the same way the Loyalists had been, when they hadn't been defeated in battle at all, is a real insult. And for Brant and the Mohawks and the Haudenosaunee, the key moment is the Treaty of Fort Stanwix in October of 1784, where the Six Nations show up thinking, well, okay, we're not in the European treaty, but we're going to negotiate our own peace treaty. And instead, one of the peace commissioners, a man from Virginia named Arthur Lee, part of the Lee family, says, "You're a conquered people." And the Six Nations are stunned. They had no idea that they would be treated with this. And it triggers a round of fighting. And the wars in the Northwest Territory, and there's also fighting in the Southwest Territory, where the Creek Nation under Alexander MacGillivray, another indigenous leader, ally with Spain. These wars go into the 1790s, and it's actually one of the things that really underscores the weakness of the American Confederation before the Constitution, because they don't go well. And the U.S. forces continue to lose. The Creeks lay siege to Nashville, and the settlers of Nashville approach the Creeks about placing themselves under Alexander MacGillivray's protection. So it's a sign of that silence on indigenous rights in both these peace treaties is a major, major silence. And it's an open question exactly how that's going to be resolved in the period that we're talking about. Mm-hmm.
And so one of the themes that you refer to maybe in that book, or maybe I haven't read, obviously, I haven't read The Crucible because you haven't finished but I've read your abstract. And you imply that in some ways, independence made Britain's job easier in managing its.
Well, you know, so the imperial crisis had started in the 1760s, growing out of Britain's attempt. They don't tax the Americans to pay off their debt. That sometimes is they're taxing the Americans to help pay for the costs of an expanded army and navy because of these victories during the Seven Years' War. And actually, this map dates back to the Seven Years' War. So in some ways, you know, again, this is Shelburne's vision. He says, let them govern this. They're still going to buy British manufacturers, which is what they do. what we do. You know, there is an American factory system that develops, but it's very much subsidiary to the big workshops in places like Manchester and Birmingham, shipping out of Liverpool. You know, the United States is the big purchaser of British manufactured goods for most of the 19th century. And they no longer have to pay for the defense. That's being handled by Congress and the U.S. government. So it's what we sometimes call an informal empire. In many ways, the United States is part of Britain's commercial informal empire. You know, it's anyone's guess when that changes, but it's sometime after the American Civil War, between sort of 1865 and the First World War.
And that's the Jay Treaty.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah, absolutely.
So talk
yeah.
about how this Treaty of Paris and the period right after set up the Jay Treaty or solved the problems or created problems.
He goes back, in this case, he's in London, and what Jay achieves, it's one of the reasons why it's controversial, because basically Britain agrees to do in the Jay Treaty what they'd already agreed to do. They finally pull their soldiers out of the Western Post. So we haven't talked about the fact that the British continue to occupy a string of forts from Michilimackinac up at the top of Lake Huron in Michigan. The big ones are Detroit and Niagara. They have two forts at the top of Lake Champlain, Oswego. All of these are in what, according to the Treaty of Paris, is supposed to be American territory, but they stay there. And they continue to provide weapons and assistance to people like Joseph Brandt. They're careful not to get dragged into a formal war with the United States, but they're fighting a proxy war. I mean, we see things like this elsewhere in the world today. And so the British are, you know, and Jay gets them to agree to turn those posts over to the United States, which they do. But one of the reasons the treaty is controversial is that the United States is basically making nice to Britain for doing what it was supposed to have done in 1783. You know, there are a lot of people say, you know, why did it take so long? And they're also, their commission set up to resolve loyalist claims, which are left over from the treaty. And there are also commissions. Oh, there's also a commission over the border, which is very interesting on this map. This is the British map that shows the border with Canada, you know, on this New Brunswick, Maine line being the easternmost line, which is where Adams said it was supposed to be. In fact, the Loyalists who moved there in 1783, built a town, St. Andrews. I don't know if anyone's been to St. Andrews, New Brunswick, a lovely town. You'll see in there houses that were originally built at Penobscot, Castine, Maine, taken apart when the treaty is published and floated up the coast. They rebuild this loyalist settlement at St. Andrews. It's west of the Magadavik River, what the Americans say is the St. Croix. This map suggests the Americans are right to claim that, but ultimately, as a result of the Jay Treaty, they set the boundary farther east on the Schoodick River, what today is called the St. Croix. This map stays under wraps. The British won't even let it out until the end of the 19th century. You wouldn't have been able to see it. Because of course it suggests that the American claim was right. But yeah, so these are, so, you know, Jay's treaty, and one of the points I'm making in this new book, and it comes through in Among the Powers as well, is we like to think of peace and justice working together. They almost never do. Each side has to give up some of what it regards as just. Of course, you know, for Native Americans, oftentimes the sacrifice of justice is a sacrifice that more powerful players are making on their behalf. And so oftentimes, and the other thing is that one person's peace is sometimes another person's war. And that's the indigenous story of this treaty too.
So we are out of time. And I want to end with one of our student questions again, which is this, a, or I'm modifying your question, which is this a good model of how a world of a, the responsibility of a world power to help a developing nation? Do world powers have a responsibility to help developing nations? And is this a good model or an imperfect model or a terrible model of how that should work?
Boy, I'm reluctant to give Britain too much credit, but when you compare the United States' entry into the Community of Nations with the entry of Haiti and the Latin American republics, Britain comes off looking a lot better. You know, Haiti had to purchase its independence at the price of over $1 billion. That the legacy of that is still with
it's
the
still
Haiti Haitians today. They had to pay France that. And Spain refused this kind of international agreement, and that leaves a mark. So in some ways, that's a great question. And, you know, of course, the United States doesn't get everything it wants, but you never do. So, you know, I'll have to think about that. I know this is being recorded. I don't want to go on record saying something I'll regret, but that's an interesting, and I think a lot of people have looked at Lord Shelburne through that lens. He comes off looking like a very enlightened statesman.
Well, when you finish this book and when the homestead finishes its renovation, we will bring you back to have you talk in our beautiful ballroom about this most important bunch of issues. So we're going to stop now. I know we can't, there's a lot to talk about here. So thank you for having written such a mind expanding book to pull New Yorkers from our very parochial view of the revolution and for giving us a view of your work to come, which we will tell all of you about as soon as we know about it ourselves, including whether this stays the title. And obviously for being such a magical teacher. Everyone, Lige will be signing books upstairs. And come, if you want to join the Scholars Committee and help us design next year's season, then please let us know. There's lots of room. And we're now under performance pressure to outdo this season, which has been so great. So thank you so much. And let's go upstairs.
Okay, thank you. And thanks for the great questions. Yeah.